And welcome everyone to an extremely special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
Hello.
A big spirited hello, because we've got a big spirited episode today. Joining us for a chat is special guest Damian K. Leahy, a Jacksonville, Florida native. Damian graduated from Douglas Anderson School of the Arts High School and is an alumnus of the University of North Carolina School of the Arts Film School. Damian has produced and or written several independent films, including festival blazing cult faves Ding-a-ling-less, directed by indie maverick Honor Tuchel, and the critically acclaimed anti-drug film Cocaine Angel, directed by indie stalwart Michael Tully, which premiered at Rotterdam International Film Festival and South by Southwest. Damian was a staff writer contributing editor for Indie Slate magazine from 2006 to 2011. In 2008, he won a Creative Excellence Award for screenwriting at Slamdance. Damian has also worked as a freelance screenwriter, director, and UPM on several commercials, music videos, and shorts over the years, including Children for a Day in 2008, which finished up a successful festival run in 2010, winning a slew of awards. The last feature film he wrote and directed, the holiday comedy drama The Heroes of Arvine Place, was shot in Jacksonville, Florida, and also had a very strong festival run, winning several awards, and was picked up for distribution and released in December of 2014 on Blu-ray and multiple online platforms. We're definitely going to dig into that movie, lovely, lovely little film. In July of 2014, Leahy wrote and directed the short comedy horror piece Soccer Moms in Peril in Los Angeles, which had its world premiere at Dances with Films in Hollywood in June of 2015. It recently finished a successful festival run, even winning a jury award at the prestigious Indie Memphis Film Festival and Best Comedy Horror Film at the Chicago Horror Film Festival. Damian kicked off 2016 shooting another short film, District Quarantine, in Los Angeles, which was recently completed and will begin its festival run in 2017. He's currently in pre-production on another short film, Captain Traer Smiles at the Stars, which will shoot in Los Angeles in February of 2017. That will complete a trilogy of genre short films titled Three Slivers of the Moon, which all feature star Tara Despain, Damian's longtime cinematographer, Tarina Van Den Dreeshish, hope I said that name right, sound designer Joshua Chase, and editor, co-producer, and all-around collaborator Craig Moorhead of the Never Heard of It podcast, which, of course, Frank and I are big fans of. So after that big mouthful, welcome to the show, Damian. Thank you so much for coming on. Let's kick off this rager in high style.
All right, man. Well, thank you guys, one, for having me and on here, but also for that glorious the introduction. I was not expecting that. Thank you so much, Nick.
Yeah, you know, I think that is the longest introduction Nick has ever read on the podcast.
That was a you definitely combined enough things, but that was great, and I really appreciate it. And I want to take a moment, though, and let you guys know how much I appreciate what you guys do in regards to, you know, the excitement level and the appreciation of cinema from all walks of life. I mean, you guys go deep no matter what it is. And, you know, the guest you have on your podcast definitely reflects that. And I mean, I have so much fun. I've listened to so many of these things, and you know, whether it's Goldblatt, which was epic, Rennie Harlan, I learned so much from that one. Bradford May, Wild Man, Terry McMahon, that guy was out of control. I love that one. And then of course, Matthew Sand was excellent. Daniel Waters, William Wisher. I mean, you guys really bring it, and your appreciation for cinema and it's just out of control, and it's really inspiring. And it's been a great year rocking and rolling with you guys, you know, not only, you know, checking out your podcast, but also, you know, raging with you guys online for all sorts of movies, right? And actually got to meet Frank when I was in Chicago for the Chicago Horror Film Festival. we Frank was kind enough to bring me to one of his favorite local spots, the Burgundy. I had a great country fried steak there, some open medium, some over medium eggs. But no, man, it's fantastic. So thank you guys for having me on here. You guys do a great service to all of us in the business.
Thank you very much for the kind words, man. It's been a lot of fun. It's always a pleasure when you can meet people. It doesn't matter how you meet them, but that they just share so much of the similar passion for movies and for exploring cinema and for finding movies that, you know, might not be the most obvious pick or, you know, just learning about cinema on a daily basis. I mean, it's really been fun. And your excitement level certainly gets me excited, and it's definitely been a lot of fun. So thanks again for coming on, and we're going to find out more about your work as a filmmaker.
Well, thank you. Ask me anything.
What's K stand for in Damien K. Leahy?
Stands for killer, Frank.
Actually, put this in context. Just to put this whole conversation in context. Hang on. Okay. So I picked Damien up from his friend's house in Chicago, and we were going to get something to eat, and then I couldn't see his film, unfortunately, because I had a prior engagement. So we went to the Burgundy, which was this quaint little diner, you know, the little typical city diner. And not only do Damien and I share a passion for cinema, but we also share a passion for the Rolling Stones. And somehow, one way or the other, a Rolling Stones song, I don't remember which one it was, came on in the diner, and I have never seen anyone booth dance with such gusto while eating country fried steak like I have with Damien.
I was jamming like a salmon, brother. I couldn't help myself. The Stones came on. You know, I was on vacation. I was hanging out with Frank. Hey, man, it went over well at the Burgundy.
Yes.
You know what I mean? They were down.
You complimented every single person who worked there about how much you loved the Burgundy Diner. Regrettably, we didn't take a photograph, but the memories will never fade of the Burgundy.
But my name actually, the middle initial K stands for Kim. Damien Kim Leahy. My father was Hawaiian, and that actually leads me, if we're gonna go autobiographical. My grandmother lives in South Windsor, Connecticut, which is where the mighty Clement here also lives. I was actually the first baby born in Connecticut in 1978, 45 seconds past midnight at Hartford Hospital. So So if I don't really make it in cinema, you know, I've got that I can always kind of, you know, hang my hat on that trophy. You know what I mean? I've been rocking that since day one, baby. But
out of all the places.
Hey now, Nick, back off, man. I did get a key to the city by the mayor that was gifted to me when I was born on that fateful day in 1978. So, you know, let's not forget that. Okay.
So you can just walk straight into Nick's house with your key.
If I get thrown out of it everywhere else, Connecticut will always have me. But I visit my family's from there, and when jobs shifted and the economy shifted, they shifted down south to Florida. But I go and visit over the holidays. So me and Nick are going to be throwing down like nobody's business this holiday season there in Connecticut.
Live and in concert.
Right. Exactly. So we're definitely going to be, I don't know, my cousin, is going. I'm going to be showing up on the 21st, so we're definitely going to make plans one way or another to hang out while I'm there. Plenty of time.
Oh, absolutely. So, and my first question for you is, what does Cavaris Film stand for?
Kavaris film. Okay, when I was in high school, Angela Roberts, who I am still a great friend of mine, but she used to call me Karis, right? Because Father Damien Karis from The Exorcist. But I always thought she was saying Kavaris, so it just kind of stuck. Because you got to keep in mind, I grew up in an era where nobody named their kid Damien because you had to hear about The Omen all the time. So my mom didn't go to the movies and didn't realize when she named me Damien, she thought, you know, she was doing this really clever thing by naming me after Saint Damien of the Lepers because it was like Catholic household. She didn't realize that that was the summer that The Omen came out. You know what I mean?
So the fact a Satan baby named Damien had no bearing on her.
Right. And I was a little bit of a handful. Right? So it definitely kind of backfired that. That was like a generational thing. Like now it's hip, you know what I mean? If it's like there's a kid and he's named Damien, that's like cool, you know what I mean? But then it was kind of like, but people, I mean, to this day, think they are just the most perceptive. They'll be like, hey, man, have you ever seen The Omen? And I'll be like, no. I'll be like, what is that? You know what I mean? And it'll make their day. Like, they get to be the one after all these years to introduce me to that. Like, I've never heard that before. I'm like, tell me, what's that about? But that's where the name comes from.
Well, tell us, where does your love for cinema start? Like, how did it get in your blood?
Well, I loved movies from day one. My earliest memories, begging my parents. We lived on Arvine Place. I wound up using that name for the movie, but we lived on 31 Arvine Place in Manchester, Connecticut. And I used to, hound my parents. You know, that was back when video stores were first coming out. You had to rent VCRs. VCRs were like $950. They were like the price of a Buick. You know what I mean? And these places rented them. And I was really, loved Ghostbusters, Star Wars. You know, Ghostbusters was a biggie. Ghostbusters was a big one, right? But it wasn't until we moved to Florida and I was 10 years old and I watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for the first time that I really wanted to do that. I was overwhelmed by what that could do. You know, I mean, in Connecticut, we had a number of things taped off of TV, right? So that were always on a loop. You know what I mean? Like there was a tape that had Apocalypse Now taped from television on it and Star Trek III, right, that I would watch. I would watch Apocalypse Now over and over. I would not watch Star Trek III over and over. But and I'll never forget that because Apocalypse Now was advertised. Harrison Ford was such a big deal that when Apocalypse Now played on network TV, they would advertise the film as starring Harrison Ford to get people to watch it. true story. And that's why my parents rented it because they recorded it off the TV and they were proponents of that because they didn't want me watching R-rated movies, but they knew they were edited on TV. But in regards to like the impact of what cinema could do on an emotional level, it wasn't until I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for the first time when I was 10 years old, also taped off television with my parents filling me in on certain scenes that had been cut out for running time. So that was kind of the big moment. And then after that, I just got really upset. I'm obsessed with film. we had a great video store here in Jacksonville, Video Magic, where I got my entire med education from. And, you know, it's, you know, you read things, and then, you know, if people, like, for example, if I saw things that I enjoyed, then I would want to read about them, right? Or I would want to read biographies about them. And then from the biographies, I would learn what they liked. You know what I mean? Like, and then it just kind of goes from there, because interest begets interest, right? If you're genuinely interested, then you're never going to stop genuinely learning about something. So
that's true.
That's why there's a lot of clutter when it comes to the arts, right? Because there's a lot of romanticism that's slapped on this stuff, right? At the end of the day, it all comes down to glorified project management of some type. But there's a lot of romanticism that's slapped on the arts, right? So the arts is cluttered with more people that are not genuinely into it for the right reasons. They're attracted to the romanticism as to the end result itself. Do you guys follow me on that? So for example, there's not a lot of romanticism that goes along with being a mechanic. So the industry of mechanics isn't cluttered with very many posers that are just somehow attracted to the lifestyle of being a mechanic. You never hear mechanics complaining about all those people they have to deal with that don't really have what it takes to be a mechanic. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But in film, there's a lot of people that are attracted to the romanticism of it. In the arts in general, painting, music, a lot of people are attracted to the fashion and the romanticism of it. And over time, they just find that, you know, it's not for them. You know, there's a lot more to it. So I didn't mean to go off on a tangent there.
Oh, sure.
But I'll let you know it might happen again.
How did you start making film?
Yeah.
I had a buddy of mine in middle school that we used to grab his handy cam and make these like total like cheesy ripoffs of like the Evil Dead and George Romero and that kind of stuff. But to be honest, I was in very, very strangely and very luckily, Jacksonville, Florida has one of the best magnet schools for the arts in the country. And so I got to go to there for high school, you know, and have that experience. But I always wanted to be a Bernie Taupin to somebody's Elton John. So I was like hugely obsessed with reading and books and cinema. I love cinema and all that, but I really wanted to be a lyricist, right? And I was like, man, I really don't think that's going to be I'm just not sure about that. So when I was a senior, in high school, I was like, well, it would make more sense for me to get into film school, right? And, you know, I had been a creative writer in high school. I was always doing the writing thing. And I was like, man, if I get into film school, though, I want to learn how to do everything. You know, I don't want to just be the writer. Because it always seems like if you're just the writer, then you're always on like an island by yourself. And I always found that people that were like writers got into this thing where they identified as being a writer and then identified themselves as being not a lot of other things. Like, whoa, I'm a writer type. Like, whoa, don't ask me to set up the DVD player writer here, you know. Like, driving the directions on how to get to grandma's house. Whoa, slow down. In case you haven't noticed, I am a writer, you know? And I was like, I didn't want to get into that because I think that's bullshit. So even though I did the screenwriting thing at North Carolina School of the Arts, it was really important for me to learn project management. At the end of the day, the writing and all of that hasn't been as successful or fortuitous for me as like learning how to be a project manager, learning how to promptly respond to emails and schedule and budget and things like that, because that all involves follow through. And there's talent is as common as cheeseburgers, but discipline and follow through is always going to be in short supply.
What was what's one of your earliest recollections? What was your first short film that you made?
The first short film that I did was titled "Daughter in a Cage." That and was what, a short film that I did at North Carolina School of the Arts. That was about a demented toy maker that keeps his daughter locked in a cage. And you want to hear something funny? Is that the woman who plays the girl who was the daughter in the cage is Megan Brothers, okay? And she is actually a very successful young gay and lesbian adult and an author. And she is actually my sister from another mister, if there ever was one. When it comes down to Bruce Springsteen, when it comes down to Bloom County, when it comes down to the X-Files, Wild Tigers, she's right there with me. And I actually spent, and there's a lot of people that, you know, I went to school with in my class that, you know, for one reason or another, they get involved in other things in life. But Megan, give her a shout out. If you ever want to check out any of her books, she wrote Supergirl Mixtape. She wrote Weird Girl and What's His Name is her newest one, and Debbie Harry Sings in French. She is awesome. And I actually, Nick, while you and I have spent a large part of the year bullshitting back and forth about movies, right? May it be, you know, the director's cut of 1900, right? Or, you know, The Formula and, you know, stuff like that. Me and Megan have ping-ponged back and forth about working on something together.
Oh, so another collaboration.
We've ping-ponged back and forth about something, but we haven't figured it out yet. Right now, we're at a standstill with that.
And what would be like one of your earliest like recollections from your first short film? Like, what was one of the hardest things that you had to overcome as a first-time filmmaker?
Well, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, Nick. I was, you know, it was just I was in film school. I was 5 years old toiling over a steam deck or anything. It was, so when I did Daughter in a Cage, I mean, that was in the context of film school. And actually, Chris Gebert was the cinematographer on that. And Chris Gebert actually was my best friend in college. He went on to do all the sound stuff for David Gordon Green. And then he shot Daughter in Vindicage. But this is film school where each year you do a couple of films. I did a short film called The Brontosaurus of Love my second year. Man, I haven't talked about this stuff in forever. I did Cathedrals of Alice. Imaginary History of Croquet was one we did in my third year with, and I'll talk about that one simply because it ties into what I'm doing now, because the Imaginary History of Croquet, I wrote and I was a producer on. A buddy of mine, Benji Gillespie, directed it, but it starred Tara Despain, and it starred actually Craig Moorhead. And as you know, Tara Despain is, you know, acts in these things that I do, is part of the team. And of course, Craig is also one of my main guys as well.
Yeah, so Damien, you went to the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, the film school, and there's been a lot of, you know, it's been a sort of a hotbed of talent, specific talent to come out of that program. you know, guys like Jeff Nichols, David Gordon Green. Tell us about your experiences there and what that was all about.
Well, I thought it was an awesome experience. David Gordon Green was two classes ahead of me. Okay. So Chris Gebert, who I mentioned went on to be his sound guy, who was my best friend in college. He's not a big social media guy. We don't talk that much anymore, but back in college, he was in my class. Okay. He was older. He had already been to college. I talked about Negan, like in our class, Josh Chase, who's gone on to do great stuff in sound, and, Negan, who I mentioned, and, there's been a couple of other people from our class that have gone to do crew stuff. A lot of the people in my class, though, have gone on and they either work sporadically in cinema, right? So basically, like, some people have gone on, and a lot of people from our class have gone on and kind of realized that, you know, the filmmaking wasn't something that they wanted to super pursue. So they've, like, you know, they've gotten their master's degree and moved on to other things. Okay. I mean, that's just life, right? And, you can't expect everybody at 18 to know what they want to do forever. Correct. So, now Jeff Nichols but by the way, all those guys do great stuff. David Gordon Green and Jeff, they do wonderful stuff. Okay. And it's certainly a far cry from the stuff that I do. But Jeff Nichols wasn't in my class, and I only hung out with him a couple of times, but we did. He was one of the only people that was a diehard Bruce Springsteen fan. And I was a diehard Bruce Springsteen fan. I am a diehard Bruce Springsteen fan. Guys, I live and breathe Bruce Springsteen. Love the Boss. And I actually road tripped with Jeff Nichols and a couple of other guys. We went to go see Bruce Springsteen my senior year in college. But outside of that one time, like I didn't see him on campus very much. So, in regards to David Gordon Green, he actually gave me a perm in one of his short films at one time. And then when I did Cocaine Angel, I had Craig Zobel, who did – have you guys seen Compliance?
Yes.
Yes, Craig Zobel was me. I hung out a lot with Craig Zobel when I was in college. Like, he was, like, in a core group of people that we all kind of hung out with, you know? So I kind of spent more time with those guys. And like I said, David was in, like, two classes ahead of me. So, but years later, when we did Cocaine Angel, I had talked with – I was doing a film called Simple Vengeance. And then we went back and forth. This is such a long time ago. We went back and forth about that. I had written this screenplay. I had been paid by this company, and I had let him read it. And we went back and forth about that. He was doing Pineapple Express at the time. But him and Craig Zobel had done a project called Dearborn. This actually leads into one of the best experiences of my life that involved a film never getting made, okay? Is that I was David Green was doing this movie called All the Real Girls. Have you guys ever seen that?
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's one of the cities done.
Craig Zobel was working on it, and they were developing this new film called Dearborn, and which they wrote together. And I was going to be a unit production manager on it, okay? And I was actually up there where they did all the Real Girl stuff, and I was developing this Dearborn project. That film never got made, whatever. But one of the best experiences of my life was that location scouting for this film. I got to drive through all of Virginia, West Virginia. I got to go to the Christmas tree capital of the world. And I got to visit places. And I always talk about this as one of the biggest things about independent film. If I was to ever say, what did you get out of it? The most important thing that I ever got out of doing this stuff was getting to travel and meet all different kinds of people all over the world. And it's funny because it would have been great if that film got made, whatever. But that experience and those pictures that I took from that whole location scouting and doing all that was fantastic. That was great. Now, in regards to, and Craig's gone on and done great stuff. He's so talented. You know what I mean? Once again, I don't do stuff like that. And, but when we did, so when I was back in Wilmington ever after Cocaine Angel, and I had, and this is cool because I don't talk to Chris that much anymore, but we went back and forth because I sent him a copy of District Quarantine to check out. Right? So we're on memory lane. Okay, guys, are you with me?
I'm with you.
So I sent Chris a copy of District Quarantine and we went back and forth. But the last time that I had really talked with either of them was David was doing this remake of Suspiria, was in talks with doing this remake of Dario Argento's Suspiria. And I had done all these presentations in film school on Dario Argento. And me and Chris used to watch Dario Argento films. And you know what I mean? That was our thing. I mean, we used to watch tons of movies, tons of sleazy horror movies, but we were big into Dario Argento. And Chris reached out to me because he was developing that screenplay with David, okay? And we wound up going back and forth. He sent me a copy of it. We wound up going back and forth for about a week on that. And then I gave him notes on what he had. I wrote some scenes for it, but I don't think they used. I was trying to, like, angle myself, right, as to how I could get into this. Like, I was like, wow, this is cool. This could be happening. They're wanting my advice. How do I get in here? You know what I mean? Like, whoa. I would make suggestions, right, and then strategically write scenes to try to, like, you know, get my foot in the door more with the project. But I kept trying to mimic these off the top of your head kind of dialogue scenes in Dario Argento movies, which aren't funny, but they're weird. And I guess it's because they're foreign and also because he has a weird sense of humor. And I was trying to mimic that, and it was completely backfiring. Like, I was writing all these weird, like, LSD-inspired jokes that, like, weren't happening at all. and it was funny because I had, like, given, you know, Chris some, like, Chris sent me his, like, draft of the script, and I sent him, you know, these somewhat harsh notes, right? And then, like, then when it was time for me to come to the table, I was like writing, I was like totally bombing, writing all these like shitty, like bizarre, like LSD inspired kind of off the top of your head sequences that kind of, you know, recreate that Suspiria vibe. But they wound up, I went to Mexico to work on this documentary, but they like after I was talking with Chris for that about a week, and then they had mentioned that it wasn't going forward, you know, because I had like written my scenes, and then I don't think they used more than two of them at the most that wound up in whatever draft they were working on. Okay, so I'm certainly not going to try to exaggerate my involvement there, but after that, that didn't happen. The project didn't move forward. And then since after that, we just kind of, you know, lost touch. Or rather, I've been in touch with Chris here and there. But, you know, that was the last of that. But you guys know, you guys got to pal around with Chad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Chad was great. Right. Yeah. I can't wait to see Love.
Right. But Chad, I actually hired him to work on a couple of shows that I did in Wilmington, North Carolina. Okay. So, which, you know, those guys there in Wilmington, that's where I really got my education in filmmaking. Okay. Was in Wilmington, North Carolina. So I got to take a moment and give them respect. And it's just very funny because now Chad is, who I've always stayed in touch with. He's a great guy, huge Dylan fan, but, it's cool because now he's working with Jeff Nichols after all that time. But Wilmington, North Carolina was very, very influential in giving me the confidence in what I needed to be a filmmaker when I went and did my own films. When I went to Wilmington, to produce these independent films, you know, like Ding-a-ling-less, Ball of Wax. Ball of Wax was the first film that I produced in Frank. That was written and directed by Daniel Krause, who lives in Chicago and who is the author of those Zebulon Finch novels. He did Monster Variations. He did Rodders. He's kind of like a local celebrity in Chicago. If my flight, you remember, Nick, I was yelling and screaming to you when I was trying to get to Chicago because I was supposed to arrive in Chicago at 9 a.m. I didn't arrive till 9 p.m. But yeah. I was supposed to meet up with Dan that day, Frank. That's the friend that I was referring to that I didn't get to meet before I met you.
Right.
Right. So basically, I got my crash course there because I wanted to learn the fundamentals of that, right? Of what went into making a film. So when I did my own film, I would know.
How did
you? So a lot of us kept in touch.
How did you hook up with Craig in film school, and how have you maintained a relationship with him to this day?
Well, a lot of it's, Craig was in a different class than I was in. Okay. So Craig was in a different class than I was in. And then Facebook is like one of the greatest things that's ever happened to me, to be honest. I don't care what anybody says, but, that's how I rekindled, that's how all this rekindled kind of our relationships. But essentially, years later, when I was going to do the Heroes of Arvine Place, I was friends with Craig on Facebook, and, you know, I had sent him some of my stuff, and long story short, though, is that I was either going to act in the Heroes of Arvine Place, or I was going to, direct it, and I reached out to Craig to direct it. And he convinced me that I should direct it because he was like, what do you want to do really, right? And I was like, well, I'm not really comfortable with the acting thing. That's not really my deal. I don't really – been listening, guys. I think first of all, I don't think I'm that good. But second of all, I think there's something – I think actors, I think everybody who does a certain job on these films, right, has certain psychological requirements, right? Like they have certain psychological needs. I think actors have certain psychological needs that is why they act. And I personally don't have those requirements, so I don't feel the need to be an actor, right? So basically, I was going to direct the Heroes of Arvine Place, and then Craig offered to cut the film, right? I mean, he's worked for National Geographic. He works for Discover now. He's done all sorts of stuff. He offered to go ahead and cut the picture, which was actually a lifesaver. Because after he turned down directing it, we didn't talk for a while. And then I was literally just sending him an update on as to what was going on with the film guy. And he offered to do it.
Wow. So I guess this is a good time to talk about Heroes of Arvine. We can bounce around, but you know, the Heroes of Arvine Place, it's just a really, really well observed, honest, thoughtful piece of filmmaking. The storytelling felt very organic, you know, and touching in a way. And without spoiling it, give listeners sort of like the log line, the pitch on Arvine Place, and how did it all come about?
Well, basically, it's about a struggling, you know, a widower and a struggling, you know, he's a children's author, and he's trying to take care of his family during the holidays, right? And, you know, he doesn't have a job, and he's kind of somebody that's, you know, his wife's all, you can tell that his wife, who passed away, always wore the pants in the family while he was Mr. Artist guy, and now he's got to raise the kids on his own. I wanted to do something. Hey, listen, guys, I am made of Christmas spirit, okay? I am a total sentimental sap for the holidays. I have been accused of being a sentimental sap in general, but when it comes to the holidays, I am total mush, right? So, you know, just being around that season always gets me amped, you know? And I had actually the story goes back further than that, to be completely honest. What happened was me and Michael Tully were developing Cocaine Angel, right? Years before. And I was dating a wonderful woman. She had three children, right? She was awesome. Anyway, I was watching them one weekend while she was at work, and I was actually working on a children's story. Now, that children's story that I was working on would later become the short film script in the short film Children for a Day. Okay? But while I was working on that, I came up with the idea for the Heroes of Arvine play. Right? I was writing Cocaine Angel at the time and began outlining the Heroes of Arvine play at the same time. There was a moment where me and Tully talked about doing perhaps the Heroes of Arvine play, but we didn't want to deal with working with kids, so we didn't. We moved on. But the main inspirations for that film, because we're total geeks like that, is that the tone that I was going for in the texture, and I really appreciate the kind words, Nick, because it is just a really small movie, is just, you know, I wanted to get, even though I wasn't going to be able to compete at all, but I wanted to do the tone, the texture of Nobody's Fool with Paul Newman by Robert Benton, then Bronco Billy, directed by Clint Eastwood, and Terms of Endearment, and the film, very few have seen this, but if you saw it, you would see the influence on the Heroes of Arvine Place, but Author with Al Pacino.
Yeah, man, and I mean, big or small, it doesn't really matter what, I mean, for me personally as a viewer, you know, it all comes down to the characters and the story, and, you know, am I moved, and do I believe it, and, you know, it doesn't matter if it costs, you know, $5,000, $50,000, or $50 million. I mean, some of the biggest pieces of shit, you know, with the biggest budgets come out every week. And, you know, there's dozens of small films that don't get the exposure, the attention that they deserve. And, you know, when you watch a movie like Arvine Place, you sense that the filmmaker is telling something that's personal to them and it means something. And, you know, you're not burdened by any sort of expectation that, you know, anybody else would have, you know, for the film in any way.
Well, thank you very much, man, for saying all that. And, you know, the film did connect with people, and I'm glad that it did connect with people. It started off, it was a slow ramp up on the festival circuit, and there was definitely some stress there, but then it really wound up picking up steam, and it wound up playing. I mean, River Run International, the Kookaloris, you know, we were really blessed that it wound up in Virginia, Fort Lauderdale, wound up really playing some really nice festivals on the circuit, but it didn't start that way. It really ramped up over time.
And I've heard you use the phrase that, you know, you're a micro budget filmmaker and that's what you considered that movie. What is it like making a film of that size, you know, and what are your expectations as a filmmaker when you're working in that realm?
That's a great question. And I'm actually really glad you asked that, because I would have forgotten to bring it up myself. I think it's really important to set the proper expectations for yourself, okay, as a filmmaker and just as a person, okay, when you're doing something small like this. Okay, you have to present yourself in a way that's appropriate to what you're doing. All right, listen, if you're making a movie for $35,000 and you're stomping around like you're Fellini, okay, it's going to blow up in your fucking face. Right? If you're making a movie for $75K and it's a horror movie and you want to, you know, stick your nose up in the air, like, you know, you're the hippest thing to ever come to filmmaking, then it's just always going to, it's just not going to work, man. It's, listen, if you make a movie with your friends, if you get a bunch of friends together and you make a movie, then you say, I got together with a bunch of my friends, some actors, some non-actors, and we went ahead and made a movie and we did our best, you know, whatever. You go ahead and present it for what it is, then, I mean, you're only going to benefit from that, right? But if you try to put yourself out there, if you're a micro-budget filmmaker, you're putting yourself out there like your shit doesn't stink, like you're Soderbergh or something. I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous. It's so self-defeating. I see a lot of these people do that, and it's something that I've never signed off on, and I'm never going to sign off on it. I'm never going to sign off it, even if I do become something bigger than that, right? I don't think it's appropriate. And I think for independent filmmakers, they should always, you know, put the numbers in your favor, right? Like you already don't have $60 million. You already don't have Brad Pitt. You're already pushing a boulder up a hill. On top of that, don't shoot yourself in the foot by masquerading like you're, you know, Quentin Tarantino, or, you know, you're Ty West or Rob Zombie or whoever the fuck you want to try to, you know, because it's not about you. You know, the most important thing is you're in a filmmaker's mind is seeing a so-and-so film on the title screen, stick a fork in them, man. They're already done. Even if they do make a one-off good film, they're friggin' done, you know, because the story's bigger than you. The story's bigger than a so-and-so film. You know what I mean? Don't put yourself in front of the story. You know, I mean, the guys from like a couple decades ago, I mean, the auteur theory and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Hey, man, I get it. That was the trend for a while. But hey, I'm aware of all the moving parts. I'm not going to put a Damien K. Leahy film up there. That just doesn't sit well with me. You know what I mean? I mean, but for some people, again, going back to some people have different psychological needs and wants than others. But, you know, Kurt Vonnegut has a great quote, and that is, you know, unfortunately, most decisions that guide men's lives are based on vanity and not wisdom, you know? And I see a lot of vanity leading the way in some regards where it should be wisdom. And humility, especially if you're doing these things on a small scale. You know what I mean? The stuff I do is so small in terms of the big picture. You just got to be realistic with, you know, with yourself. And you'll not only be happier, you'll probably live longer too.
I feel like you should have ended the Vonnegut quote with a boom exclamation point.
thank you, Frank.
No, you're welcome. How does it feel to make Arvine Place and knowing that it's just touching people on a deep level?
Well, when you get up there and I mean, it's again with that film, it was a gradual climb. But obviously, when it got towards the end of the run and, you know, I was at Virginia with Craig and it was, you know, selling out these theaters and large percentage were staying after for the Q&A and people were generally, they were into it. You know what I mean? They were into it. And it feels really good. And I don't want to debase that, but I do have to say that there's a lot of rejection in various ways, in various shapes and sizes when you're doing these things. Rejection on so many different levels, not just from film festivals, from people you work with. Rejection comes in all, like I said, shapes and sizes. And it's so, it can be so consistent and so relentless. And you have to keep pushing forward, that when good things do begin to happen, it's less, you feel less than elated than you do just relieved that it wasn't more rejection in one way, shape, or form. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when there's more like a sense of relief that, you know, it's processed more like that than it is like, yes, and like high fiving people. You know what I mean? You have, it's more of a, it's more of that feeling. So, but obviously, it did, once you get past that, it did feel great to see the, especially at River Run International, you know, such, you know, those kind of places. It's an honor, you know, it really is.
And, you know, and for a film like Arvine Place that, you know, that lives on the festival circuit and is dependent on, I would assume, how much the filmmaker is able to commit to getting the movie out in front of audiences and festivals. You know, how was it like getting the film out on disc? Like, what was the process for a filmmaker in your position to, you know, to get that physical media release and not just rely on streaming? Because, you know, Frank and I, we've always, you know, we advocate physical media all the time. We constantly talk about discs that people should, you know, check out, they should grab, you know, because I think that the tangible nature of holding a movie in your hand, for me, will always beat, you know, the streaming options, no matter how great they are. What was that like to get a disc for your film?
Man, I am so glad that you brought that up, because I am the big, you know, and for me, the job is not done till I have a physical product that I could mail to people around the holidays. That's my ultimate goal. At the end of the day, I've got to have that physical property that I can give out. I can do one of my holiday giveaways, whether it's the little albums I've done, right? Even Cocaine Angel when it was on DVD. To me, it's the job's not done till I have that. Like Three Slivers of the Moon, I've already talked to a couple of places about teaming up with us to do a short Blu-ray run of that when it's completely done, you know? And I'm a proponent of it. I build it into my budget. I'll be completely honest with the Heroes of Arvine Place. We, towards the end of that experience, I was still working on the film, and some other people that had originally been working on it were no longer working on it. I was quite tired and quite ready to move on, right? And so I found a distribution place, and the first place that said yes, I let them have it. And I had already had budgeted to pay for the Blu-rays myself, and I said, I'm going to go ahead and have Blu-rays. And if I want to give them away or throw them out the window, I can do whatever I want with them. And they were like, that's fine. So that's what I did. If I ever... You know, one of the things, you know, I do freelance screenwriting, and, you know, for example, the current assignment that I'm on right now, you know, that's one of the things that I'm going to talk about is like, hey, you know, I do it for X amount, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I got to have some sort of physical copies because that's what I'm in it for. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just really into that. And, you know, like the places we talked to about Three Slivers of the Moon, you know, about putting it out there. I mean, I'm going to flat out offer, like, you know, I'll pay for the disc. Like, that's already budgeted in my life budget to pay for that myself. You know what I mean? Like, I care about it, so therefore I'm going to do it. You know, people that, you know, if I was a fisherman, I would spend the money on fishing gear, right? If I was into golf, that same amount of money would go to golf equipment. So that's why I don't get when it comes to like filmmaking and stuff, people are like, I don't know, spending your own money seems kind of weird. And it's like, why would it be weird? That's what I want to do.
Right.
No one's busting your balls about the fact that, you know, you could have gotten by with a $16,000 car, but you drive a $30,000 car. But I want to spend an additional $2,000 on Blu-rays, and all of a sudden I'm irresponsible. Get out of my face. You know what I mean? I don't have patience for that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, you know, you spend your time and your money on what you care about the most. Right? A lot of people will never admit that. But you spend your time and money on what you care about the most. Right? Nobody would bat an eye if I said, whoa, you know, I'm on football games and football parties, I spent $3,000 this year. That would be accepted. But $2,000 on, like, you know, or $1,000 on making copies of one of my EPs to some people, like, grates them. You know what I mean? Or there's those holdouts. There's, like, filmmaking holdouts or musician holdouts that are like, oh, I'm not going to spend my own money. That makes no sense to me. It's absolutely backwards. You know?
No, I was going to say, and it separates people, you know, and it separates a certain class of people from, you know, from the other. Like, you know, I mean, when you're investing your own time, not only your time, but your own money in your art, then it means something. And I would imagine different than it might in other situations. So you kind of see, you know, who's really in it to win it.
You know, right. Exactly.
Not to pimp one of our first podcasts, but this reminds me of when our first big podcast with our first guest was with Mark Pellington, and we got to talk to him about I Melt With You, which is one of my favorite movies ever. And he talked about financing the film with his own money, and he met with Steven Soderbergh and asked Steven Soderbergh, would you put your own money into your film when you knew that nobody else would, or you wouldn't have to chase people for money? And Pellington said that Soderbergh said, absolutely, I would. And I think that perfectly comes back to what you were saying about, yeah, I'm going to invest my own money in this, and yeah, I'm going to pay for Blu-rays because this is my baby.
Right. Yeah, you know what exactly.
I mean? This is exactly what I want to spend my money on, and this is why I'm doing that.
Right. Exactly. Now, I need to check out that podcast too, by the way. I haven't listened to that one yet.
Now, going forward, have you thought about chasing people for money, essentially?
Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. Orner Tuchel, who recently directed Cat Fight, which played at Toronto, and he had he was like my first guy. Like when I went to Wilmington after film school and I did those independent films, and Orner took me been under his wing. I was just some like wannabe filmmaking like drunk kid. I didn't know anything, you know what I mean? Except I was willing to work and have a good time, right? But his executive, the producer who helped him out with some of his independent films, has actually stepped in and helped out with Three Slivers of the Moon. So some of that has been covered by our executive, the producer on that, Clifford McCurdy, who is an awesome guy. So, but in regards to the following project we do, to answer your question, it's going to be yes. Like I'm slowly moving in that direction because I need to, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of on a 2-year kind of like big push for my stuff right now. You know what I mean? Like an all in kind of thing where I was looking at it and I was like, man, I could go get my master's degree. And then I was like, what? I was like, I'm not going to go get my master's degree. I mean, I look around at some of my peers, and I'm like, man, some of these folks are dead already, and they're just waiting to be buried, you know? I'm just getting started, you know? I'm not throwing myself on the sword yet, you know? So, I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, I mean, I work with people that are extremely passionate. I surround myself with people that are extremely passionate about the things that I'm passionate about, you know, and just kind of keep my eye on the prize and just, you know, you just keep going forward.
Before we, and, you know, because we're recording this right around holiday season, you know, it had come up offline to maybe talk about some of our favorite holiday movies. And before we talk to you about, you know, what the future holds with some projects that you've got coming up, you know, next year, we'll find out a little bit more about those. We would definitely want to find out from you, and considering that Arvine Place would fall into the holiday, you know, genre, or subgenre, what are some of your favorite movies that take place during the holidays, and maybe, you know, why do you come back to those movies throughout the years?
I mean, to be completely honest, my top 10 holiday films is not going to be some mind-blowing excursion into experimental cinema of any kind. It's pretty straightforward. I say, and it's very strange the way that time is, because It's a Wonderful Life is my favorite holiday film. And it's amazing because this film's belief in mankind, that man can never give up on himself, is absolutely such a radical idea right now that it's almost like a punk rock movie conceptually. It's almost like the equivalent of punk rock conceptually is optimism. You know, there's a trend started in the 70s, right? And it's funny because I want to touch base on this, because I watched It's a Wonderful Life about a year and a half ago, and it just really struck me by how radical it was compared to cinema and TV these days. Because no matter what it is, no matter what new show is coming on HBO, no matter what new show is coming out on television or what new movies are coming out, in the last 2.5 decades, every article you read, all the interviews behind the scenes, is how dark and sleazy and nasty they're going to make it. You know what I mean? Like with True Detective, which I really enjoyed, and it was like their whole take was, we didn't think that detective shows were sleazy and hardcore enough, so we just really had to go there with this. If you go back to Hill Street Blues, that's what the guys who did Hill Street Blues said. We didn't think cop shows were sleazy enough and gritty enough and realistic. Most people aren't good. They're all bad. You know what I mean? And then, you know, when Game of Thrones came out, Lord of the Rings was just too PG for us. What if all of these characters were disgusting and nasty and there was rape and blah, 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 blah. And guys, what's funny is that I'm no prude at all. If you guys know me well enough to know I live and breathe horror movies, okay? So I am no prude. But it's amazing how absolutely cynical the medium is in regards to the characters that inhabit it. Every character has to be a bad guy. Every character has to be a nasty son of a bitch. If there's redemption, it has to be in some sort of nasty way, because everything is so just horrid in this modern world. And it clearly is horrid in this modern world. And I'm sorry, guys, but in regards to cinema, I mean, I think we could stand for some heroes coming back. You know what I mean? I mean, we need some fucking heroes back on the big screen again. You know? I mean, give me a fucking break. I'm sick and tired of every hero is going to be a guy with a drug problem and cheating on his wife and all of this stuff. I get it. You have to have some shades of gray. I understand. You know what I mean? But come on. We need to bring heroes back, not only in cinema, but in life, man. I mean, when did it become bad to err on the side of being a hero? I mean, you know, that's just my own two cents on that. And the reason I got into that is simply because It's a Wonderful Life. It struck me how it's optimism, because for years when I grew up, people would always be like, yeah, It's a Wonderful Life is great, but it's so sugary sweet like Hollywood is. And when watching it for the first time in a few years, just a year and a half ago, I was struck by how its optimism is so defiant. is so aggressively defiant compared to the lack of optimism you see in the medium these days. So that was just me on that.
No, and I agree with you. Okay. I mean, you know how much I fucking love the second season of True Detective because of how transgressive and dirty and perverse it is, and the four leads are just outcasts of society that just really serve no place.
Right.
Other than with each other. And I like that kind of stuff. I love Abel Ferrara. I love everything. And, I mean, what you're saying about we need heroes back in cinema, and it's okay for us to want to champion a clean hero in cinema, and that's what we need. That's part of the reason why I love Star Wars so much, is because, you know, I love so much dark shit, and that's probably what makes up a majority of my home filmography on disc. But, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love Star Wars, and I'll always love Star Wars because of the purity of the hero.
Right, right, and that's true. And I'm looking forward to how they develop that. You know, I didn't see. I enjoyed The Force Awakens. I didn't see it taking that stance, the way that, say, like Empire Strikes Back did. Certainly took a philosophical stance.
Right.
In the contemporary modern world, in regards to its philosophy, I didn't see that in Force Awakens.
I think we're gonna get that in Rogue One.
It's got my man Donnie Yen in it, and if they learn anything from the IP Man film, specifically IP Man 3, if there's any influence that they can take from my man Donnie Yen, it would definitely be that. So we'll definitely see what happens there. But and I'm glad you talked about Ferrara, man. I love his stuff. And I do say that True Detective Season 2, if you want my honest take, I didn't think it was bad as people said. I think it mainly, in my opinion, it faltered in the repetitive nature of the characters.
What's your next Christmas movie?
it's Scrooge, and I love Scrooge.
I fucking love Scrooged.
And then I've got Nobody's Fool on there that we already talked about. I've got a Charlie Brown Christmas on there, of course. I've got a Black Christmas by Bob Clark, the horror movie.
God, who just put that out on disc with the lady with the fucking bag over her mouth? Is that the correct movie? Yeah, dude, I've never seen it, but that cover
it
art
used
is fucking
to be
nasty.
If you stayed up late, if you ever had access to TV and you were a kid, and you stayed up late on Christmas Eve, one or two channels would play that movie at midnight every year. But I got The Christmas Carol on here, the 1984 version with George C. Scott. That is like, that's the stick a gun in your mouth version right there, boys. That is not for the faint of heart. Do not...
I've never seen that one.
What?
I've never seen that one.
Wow, that one will put a hurting on your soul. You watch that by yourself around the holidays, you might want to call a hotline or something. That is it definitely is extremely powerful, and it's George C. Scott owns it. You guys may have seen him in the formula, The Exorcist 3. But
Dolphin.
Yes, exactly. Day of the Dolphin, he was in that. But in A Christmas Carol as Scrooge, he definitely owns it. But it is heavy stuff, guys. It is so depressing, but very well done. Now, this is where a lot of people get mad at me, guys. My holiday actioner is Lethal Weapon. It's not Die Hard. I'm a Lethal Weapon guy. I've seen Lethal Weapon about 50 something times. I've seen Die Hard about 10, but I've seen Lethal Weapon about 50 something times.
Die Hard like 10.
I mean, from Eric Clapton's cheesy guitar licks, to the big hair, to the big cocaine fiends, to the Uzis.
All dressed up and no one to blow.
Right, exactly.
Briefcase, exactly. Cell phones.
Right, exactly, exactly, bro. And now the other one I got on my list, I got "Twas the Night Before Christmas" by Jules Bass, the one with the singing. No, I'm not going to say singing, but it's got a couple songs in it. That's the one with the mice in the clock tower for Santa. I don't know if that one rings a bell with you guys, but I love those songs in that. I've got them in my head all year round. And then, not to just, you know, like admit to being insane, but I've also got Elf on here, John Favreau with Will Ferrell. I love that film.
Elf is so funny.
And then I've got National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
It's a very, very solid list. And some of them would certainly end up on mine. Christmas Vacation, I can still remember seeing in the theater. Scrooged is an annual classic for me. I can still remember seeing that in the theater vivid, like it was yesterday. I remember when Bill Murray started, remember in the end credits when he's pointing like at you, you know what I mean? Like he's like, "Hey, you back there," to making all that noise. I like really thought he was pointing right at me.
Dude,
I
was like, me too. I was like,
that's awesome.
You know, one of my favorite Christmas movies, and I definitely am with you on It's a Wonderful Life. It's a movie that I think if you watch at various stages in your own life, it will mean something different and will seemingly become something different each time that you watch it. I know what you mean when people say it's overly sentimental and it's, you know, it's sugary. And yeah, it maybe has some of that, but it's not exactly that if you really look closely at what that movie is purveying. And I love it. I watch it, you know, pretty much once a year, kind of hard not to. Elf just makes me laugh so much. Like I can't look at Will Ferrell in that movie and not laugh. It's just one of the funniest things him in that suit. But one of my favorite Christmas movies is a movie called The Ref, which I think is an extremely dark, very mean-spirited, but in my opinion, very funny Christmas movie with Dennis Leary, directed by the late Ted Demme, Kevin Spacey.
That film takes place during the holidays? Oh, yeah,
yeah, Christmas,
it does, doesn't
it? You fucking not Santa the fuck out.
It has the bow around the family on the cover.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No,
I've never seen it.
That's what,
oh, dude, you'll flip.
Wow. Yeah,
you will do a Leahy Rager hard on that one.
Kevin Spacey and Judy Davis are like a bickering couple, and Dennis Leary is like a cat burglar, and he takes them hostage and makes, you know, goes home with them for Christmas Eve, and he like soon realizes that he's better off like running around town like evading the cops than being holed up with these two impossible assholes. And you know, there's like a dysfunctional son that they're dealing with, and like the extended family shows up, and it's very funny. It's the most bizarre Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer production of all time. It was like this like tiny little movie.
I had no idea that they did that. I thought a smaller production company did that, trying to push Dennis Leary over the top.
No,
I didn't realize those guys did it.
It was that period where Days of Thunder had come out. It hadn't been the blockbuster that many people thought it would be. And they were kind of like figuring out what their next transition was going to be. And then they did The Ref, and then they had the trifecta of Crimson Tide, Dangerous Minds, and the first Bad Boys all in 1995, which basically like, you know, brought them back and put them back on, you know, as the Uber producers that they, you know, were together. But yeah, no, The Ref is one of their oddest credits for sure. And definitely one of my favorite, very underrated holiday entries. Frank, what about you? What are some of yours?
I mean, you guys covered them, but I'm kind of surprised, unless you guys have just been oversaturated through years of TNT and TBS marathons. But I mean, A Christmas Story is always going to be my favorite, as I say it to dead air. But yeah, I mean,
it's so funny. You know that I do not know if I have ever seen that movie from start to finish with any sort of like mature movie watching set of eyes.
I mean, that's kind of fucked up.
I'm that way too. I've only seen it like twice.
Yeah, like I didn't that was a movie that, like, I didn't grow up with and that so many other people did. And whenever it was on, it was always the same scene where he shoots himself with the gun. So I always felt like I saw the movie, but I think I've only seen that scene like 58 times.
Like, I've seen the Fragile scene about, like, 76 times, but
dude,
only the
Darren
movie,
McGavin,
like, maybe
Darren
twice.
McGavin's one of the greatest things ever in that movie.
See, I saw – see, that kid was in – that was Billingsley, right? Billingsley?
Yeah, Peter Billingsley.
See, he was in a movie called The Dirt Bike Kid.
Right.
And, like,
yeah,
that was the –
yeah, that I've seen.
That was the Peter. I own that on Blu-ray. That was the Peter Billingsley movie that I grew up with, not Christmas Story. So, back to your list.
He's actually an Iron Man.
Is he?
He's the guy that fucking Jeff Bridges screams at when they're trying to like replicate the reactor that's in Tony Stark's chest, and it's like,
really,
it's that gigantic reactor, and it's like that scientist talking to Jeff Bridges, and Bridges just turns around and screams at him that Tony Stark built this in a cave. That's fucking Billingsley. He like pops up.
Wow.
And shit. I know. It's like, I don't know if he's like buddies with Jon Favreau or what the deal is. But anyway.
Has he done any like lead roles?
No, I don't think so. I think it's shit like that. I'm going to look him up real quick. But anyway. Yeah, for me, it's A Christmas Story, National Lampoon's Vacation. And most certainly, It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm glad that you mentioned that and brought that up, because I think now is a more. You know, like you're saying, it's like almost like this punk rock stigma to it, with the idea of like hope and not even hope, but human triumph. And I think that film is timeless. And that's a word that gets thrown around.
It's awesome.
Like a statement on a lot of films. But I mean, there's a lot of films that are dated, even though that they're quote unquote timeless. But I mean,
it has so many classic scenes in it. Like, it has classic scenes in it that have nothing to do with what the movie's about. Like, the dance scene. That's, like, classic stuff. You know what I mean? It's amazing how much stuff in that film is, like, classic and just absolutely incredible in regards to filmmaking. It's really stunning. It's such an achievement.
No, I mean, it's just... It is what it is, and it's been around forever, and I feel like that movie has kind of accrued a stigma towards it that I've seen this movie 1,000 times, so I don't ever need to watch it again. You know what I mean? Like,
that's true.
It's on TV. It's on TV every week.
For a while, it was colorized and in black and white, and they would have the marathon of it where they would play both versions back to back all day long for like the week of Christmas.
Right, and I mean, that's what they've done with A Christmas Story. And
I mean, speaking of bullshit, I just had a flashback to that. You remember when Ted Turner was like completely junkied out on that colorization kick? I mean, it took a while to wean him off of it, but man. He was mainlining that for a while. That was obnoxious. That was a dark period for for cinema lovers right there.
And then here's one that, like, I'll be curious to know if either one of you guys ever heard of this, but it's called Never Say Goodbye. And
it's a 1946
film with Errol Flynn. And it's a comedy where he has a daughter with a woman and
Of course he does.
Right. And Errol Flynn and the mom are divorced, and the daughter's so upset that they're not going to be together for Christmas and they're not going to have a family Christmas. And it's kind of this odd slapstick comedy with Errol Flynn. And I grew up watching John Wayne and Errol Flynn because my dad's obsessed with them. And that's a movie that's just always kind of stuck with me. I don't even think it ever got a disc release. It's probably just available on VHS. So
never heard of it.
That's your mission, to find that movie.
I'm sure there's a 3-disc French Blu-ray edition of it available somewhere.
I mean, there very well could be.
So, Damien, what do you love? No. What were you going to say? What do you love?
I said I love Errol Flynn.
Yeah, I've not ever even heard of that one, so I'm gonna have to, like Frank said, it's probably gonna be tough to track down, but would be fun to see. What do you personally have coming up in the near future that you can tell us about project wise?
Well, what I'm doing now is obviously the third Captain Fair Smiles at the Stars. We're gonna be shooting that next. We're going to be shooting that in January, February. And then we went through a period where we were developing a couple of different features, right? And this is actually when you, me, and Frank, we kind of started going back and forth online with all the cinemaniacs about movies and stuff earlier this year, is that I was, after we wrapped District Quarantine, I was supposed to be holed up and writing this feature we had agreed on to do. The feature, absolutely, I hit a complete dead end with it. Like, it went nowhere. It actually, like, depressed me, because I was like, man, I kind of got my team, you know, on board with this idea. We're going to do a feature next, and then we're going to do the third in a trilogy of genre shorts, right? That was kind of the timeline. You know, what good is a marksman without a mark, right? So anyway, I wound up driving myself crazy trying to bang out this feature and like screenplay. And then finally I was like, you know what? I was like, this thing's just not going to happen. But from it came the story for Captain Traer Smiles at the Star, which is more of an Ursula Le Guin, Arthur C. Clarke kind of story. Right. So, I was like, okay. I was like, this feature film idea is dead. You know, I'm not going to waste any time trying to bring it back to life, because I salvaged Captain Traer out of it, right? And, but we came up with, me and Craig, and, you know, we're trying to come up with ideas, and we're trying to run them by Tara, and because she's, you know, the actress, and want to see what she wants to do and what everybody's into. So we came up with a couple of cool ideas. One of them was like a horror thing, a horror comedy. And then the other idea I had, and this actually ties back, this is great, because this ties back into a conversation that I had with Frank when me and him were hitting up the Burgundy when I was in Chicago earlier this year. You guys may have heard about those wild times. Can't believe it was just this past September, huh, Frank?
It's like yesterday.
but no, Frank was talking about his buddy. You guys did a podcast with the dog eat dog guy, and you know, the struggle to being a freelance screenwriter and stuff like that. And I do freelance screenwriting as well. And and I've done it off and on throughout the years. And that is, and I will say that whether or not you're a freelance screenwriter for Hollywood, or whether you're a freelance screenwriter for, you know, micro budget indies or smaller type films, the percentage of your film actually getting made is about the same. So I can tell everybody who's maybe thinking, man, if I do screenplays for real cheap, for films with a smaller budget, they have a better chance of being made. If anybody's thinking that, I can tell you that chances are it might not get made. So, but one thing that I always tell people when they're going to make these small movies is, I'm like, listen, man, as I was like, if you need a writer, nobody ever wants to hire a writer when they do these things. Everybody thinks they are one. And I don't know if it's their ego or they don't want to collaborate with somebody, but you should always, you know, if you're not up to the task, if you don't have a history as a writer, you should probably, even if you come up with a good story and a good outline, should hire a writer, right? So that's what I always try to tell people. And, you know, I also practice what I preach, though. This is what I'm leading into, because the story, I came up with this story that was like a Sidney Lumet meets Alfred Hitchcock type deal. That's rather topical. And basically it involves, you know, there's like an explosion at the outset. And then, you know, like a UN aid worker and a, you know, a Middle Eastern revolutionary, or maybe it's a terrorist. We don't know, because that's kind of what the film's about. They wake up after this explosion in this bombed out room, and there's no way for them to get out, and there's a gun lying between them, right? So what happens? Okay. Now, obviously, I think that's a so my team was like, that's a good idea. Let's explore that. Let's develop that. But, you know, again, going back to what I'm saying about, you know, if you don't know what you don't know, then be cognizant of it and take the proper actions that don't involve you. So, you know, I was like, to responsibly tell this story, I need to reach out to, you know, to writers that are from the Middle East, you know. So I reached out to Samar Yazbek. I'm not sure if you guys know who that is. She's like the premier contemporary novelist, writer, journalist from, she's an expatriate. And so I reached out to her to kind of to ping pong back and forth on that. And we're still in discussions with that, going back and forth, which has been great, you know, because I'm a fan of her work. But the reason that I kind of wanted to kill two birds with one stone when you brought that up to me, because that is the next project that I'm developing. After we go ahead and shoot Captain Trailer Smiles at the Stars, the next year is going to be spent getting that screenplay into shape and shooting that the beginning of the following year. Do you guys follow me on that? But what I wanted to make clear to people who could be listening, I don't know who listens to anything, you know, aspiring, that even somebody like me that's hired, that's paid, you know, often, sporadically, but often, to write screenplays and collaborate on stories and stuff like that. Listen, when I'm getting in over my head and I don't know the subject, listen, I'm going to swallow my pride. I'm going to do as much research as I can, but, you know, I don't have, there's no pride should be involved. You got to do the right thing by your story, you know? So I'm going to go and I'm going to hire somebody with better experience that can make my story better, you know?
Absolutely. You gotta keep those fires lit.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously. Momentum is kind of one of those things that I've been through. I've been through periods where the momentum stopped, and I would prefer to not have that happen again. Like, I put a lot of effort into keeping the momentum going in one way, shape, or form, because for the momentum to drop out of me at this point would be challenging to overcome. Not that I'm getting old or anything, guys, but it would be challenging to overcome. You guys follow?
Yeah. Well, Damian, thank you very, very much for taking the time to chat with us about your work, about the films that have inspired you, and, you know, your holiday favorite classics. And obviously, it goes without saying, we look forward to seeing more of your work and to continue debating films and their merits online and everywhere else. It's definitely been fun and feels like it's a full circle thing to finally get a chance to, you know, to bullshit with you about movies.
By all means, guys, and it doesn't end here.
No.
You know what I
absolutely
mean?
Absolutely not. We got to keep that momentum going, bro.
I mean, they've got candles burning for us at the Burgundy right now, Frank. They know one day we're going to be returning. In just a couple of weeks, it's going to be cinema and pizza slices with the mighty Clement in South Windsor, Connecticut.
Well, definitely,
but
you know, I'm
but,
looking
but
forward
I
to.
Do want to, I, you know, obviously, I do want to thank you guys for having me on here. And I do want to thank you on a greater extent for reigniting that fire. Okay. Because, you know, it's definitely good to come across fresh voices and, you know, people who have the level of excitement and enthusiasm that you do. And you guys certainly bring it, you know, I've gotten to sharpen my axes so much this year from, you know, the communication that I have with not only you, Nick, not only you, Frank, but all the diehard Cinemaniacs, you know what I mean? That get mm-hmm. on there and we go back and forth about movies, you know, whether it's, you know, Patrick Crane. I'm going to shout out, you know, some of these guys because they're fucking fantastic. And they're with us day after day, night after night after night. Isn't that right, Nick?
Absolutely.
You know, guys like Patrick Crane, Michelle Kisner, Kyle Jonathan, your main man there. And of course, Devin Kelly, Osvaldo, you know, Lennart Reyes, Dag, all those guys are fucking fantastic. Rocking Bob Ellis, all of those guys, man. Tom Zielinski, all of those guys. It's fantastic going back and forth about movies with them. So definitely made
absolutely.
It's made the year a lot more fun than it would have been otherwise while I've been developing all these projects. So anyway, I guess that's it, huh, guys?
Yeah, man. Seriously, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on and giving the podcast the full Damien treatment.
Hey, no problem, guys. Then anytime. You guys have a good night.